Good evening, everybody. I'm Tom Lounges, and this is Midwest Beat. I'm back in the saddle here at Lakeshore Public Radio Studios in Merrillville, Indiana. And you are listening to us on 89.1 FM or streaming worldwide at www.lakeshorepublicradio.org. It's been a couple of weeks since I've been in studio. I've been doing a lot of work from home like everybody else. But today we are going to have a live call-in guest. I've got author Stephen Toe. And Stephen Toe, rather. And we're going to talk about his new book, How England's Capital Built Classic Rock. That's right. The title of the book is London, Reign Over Me. It's a great story about the impact the Brits have had on us, the classic rock fans. We'll have him on the horn and we'll play some great music coming up after your headlines. Good evening, everyone. I'm Tom Lounges. It's time for Midwest Beats, a program all about music, the people who make it, and the people who sometimes write about it. And that's what we've got coming up tonight. There's a brand new book out. I've got it in my sweaty little palms here. It's a great read. It's an easy read. And if you're into classic rock, it's an interesting read. Lots of history going on here in a book called London, Reign Over Me, and subtitled How England's Capital Built Classic Rock. And this is a great little book. And again, it's well illustrated. It's got some great history in it. It's published by Roman and Littlefield, and it came out in February of this year. So it's hot off the press, literally, at your local bookstores or wherever you get your books online. And we're going to talk to the author, Stephen, in just a couple of minutes. But this book, during the course of this hour, we're going to talk about the book. We're going to talk about some of the interviews he had with some of the great members of the British rock elite. A lot of the guests that have been on this show with me, artists like Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull and Colin Blundstone and Rod Argent of the Zombies, Dave Davies of the Kinks, members of the Animals. They've all been on this program, and he has talked to them, and he has taken over 90 different interviews and combined them into this really well-written book, about 198 pages, fully illustrated, and you're going to love it. The foreword is by Bill Bruford, founding member of Yes, and of course a great British prog rock guy. So we're going to get to Stephen in just a few minutes, but first let's take it back to a time before British classic rock, before all these great groups of the British invasion, like the Animals and the Kinks and Freddie and the Dreamers and Jerry and the Pacemakers and the Beatles, of course, before all these guys were doing it, they were listening to the radio. They were buying these little records, these little black vinyl things called 45 RPMs. And one of the top artists in England at that time was a young man named Lonnie Donegan. So we're going to go back and start it off just like they did when they were teenagers. 1954, Lonnie Donegan recorded a cover of Lead Belly's classic Rock Island Line for Decca Records. And this is it. This is the one that kind of got all those Brits talking about rock and roll. Let's hear it.
Now this here's a story about the Rock Island Line. The Rock Island Line, she runs down into New Orleans. And just outside of New Orleans, there's a big toll gate. And all the trains, they go through the toll gate while they gotta pay the man some money. But of course, if you got certain things on board, you're okay, you don't have to pay the man nothing. And just now, we see a train, she coming down the line. And when she come up near the toll gate, the driver, he shout down to the man. He say, I got pigs, I got horses, I got cows, I got sheep, I got all livestock, I got all livestock, I got all livestock. And the man say, well, you all right, boy, just get on through, you don't have to pay me nothing. And the train go through. And when he go through the toll gate, the train got up a little bit of steam and a little bit of speed. And when the driver think he's safely on the other side, he shout back down the line to the man. He said, I fooled you, I fooled you. I got pig iron, I got pig iron, I got old pig iron. Now I'll tell you where I'm going, boy. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride. Yes, the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. I may be right, may be wrong. You know you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is a road to ride. Yeah, the Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Hallelujah, I'm safe from sin. The good Lord's coming for to see me again. Down the Rock Island Line. line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is the road to ride. Yeah, the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you gotta ride it like you're trying to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. A, B, C, W, X, Y, Z. Cat's on the cover, but he don't see me. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is the road to ride. Yeah, the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. And if you want to ride, you gotta ride it like you're trying to get your ticket.
Lonnie Donegan, a guy who was influential beyond expectations in England to the great musicians who would later become part of the British invasion. And in my opinion, you know, rockabilly was the roots of rock here in America. And skiffle, which is what that music style was called, was the equivalent of rockabilly in England. And I've been told by many of the guests that we've had on this show over the years, the importance of Lonnie Donegan, whether it was Hilton Valentine of the Animals or Tony Iommi of Black Sabbath or Peter Noon and Carl Green of the Hermits. All of these guys at some point during our interviews have told me that skiffle was it. That's what they wanted to be. Everybody saw Elvis here in America and Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran said, that's what we want to be. Well, they were young lads in England. They were watching the TV, the telly, as they say, and wanted to be Lonnie Donegan and part of his group. So with me now is a gentleman I was telling you about as we got before the headlines there. Stephen Tao is an author who is, I believe, American-born. We'll find out in just a moment. He's written a couple of different books previously in 2011, The Strangest Tribe, How a Group of Seattle Rock Bands Invented Grunge. And his new one, as I was mentioning, came out this February, just last month, well, actually about a month and a half ago now, called Reign Over Me, How England's Capital Built Classic Rock on Roman and Littlefield, publishing that. And again, it's about, oh, let's say about 198 pages, somewhere around there, illustrated. It's an easy read. It's an interesting read. It's one of those, if you're a classic rock fan, you won't put down after just a chapter or two. You're going to want to read it from cover to cover, as I did. And without any further ado, let's meet the man that gave it to us, Stephen Tao. Are you there?
I'm here, Tom.
We finally get to talk. It's been a couple of weeks of playing back and forth with this coronavirus situation, locking everybody down. We finally get together cyberly-wise on the phone here. So, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be on.
Now, would you agree with what I just described as far as Lonnie Donegan's impact? I mean, you had mentioned him in the beginning pages of your book, and it's the same kind of, like I said, the situation. I've had several of the British artists on the show over the years, and they've all, we always, somehow, his name is brought up as an influence to them, even though you'd never really hear it in the Moody Blues or the Jethro Tulls or the Kinks music, per se.
Absolutely. And, you know, that song that you were playing, Rock Island Line, of course, is a cover of a Lead Belly song. So Lead Belly kind of led to, so he's doing this sort of country blues thing. And Lonnie Donegan made it into this, what they called skiffle over in England. But yeah, it influenced everybody. You know, people that ended up in the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and the Kinks and all those bands. And, you know, you mentioned Hilton Valentine was a huge fan of Lonnie Donegan. And you mentioned Tony Iommi, so people you wouldn't even expect, but mm-hmm. It was just such a easy way. It was almost like punk rock before there was punk rock.
Right.
You didn't have to have a lot of money and go to school for years and years to study music. You could just get a couple old instruments, make your own bass, make your own percussion, and boom, you have a band. And so that's where so many, you know, soon-to-be classic rock stars got started.
That's pretty interesting when you listen to that song, or even more so, Does Your Chewing Gum Lose Its Flavor, another big Lonnie Donegan hit. When you hear that, and then you listen to Tony Iommi's guitar playing, or Hilton Valentine's guitar playing, or any of those guys, and you try to, you know, connect the dots, it's very difficult, I guess, if you're a Yank like us.
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much that, well, we want to play like Lonnie Donegan, as it was a motivation, because he was sort of the first star, that British star that they said, okay, yeah, we want to do that. We want to have a band. And then later on, a lot of those folks got influenced by, you know, the Muddy Waters and the Big Bill Brunsies and all the great American blues artists, and mm-hmm. they ended up developing their own styles, you know, So it wasn't so much that they were like, well, let me connect, you know, how Tony Iommi's playing, you know, Iron Man or something like that to Lonnie Donegan as much as it was. It just got him going. It was sort of the first step.
Right. Now let's talk a little bit about you and how you got to where you are right now, and that is writing these great books about rock and roll. You are a professor, a teacher, correct, still?
I am.
And you're at the university level, correct?
Yes, I teach at a school called Delaware Valley University. We're about an hour north of Philadelphia.
Okay. Now, do you teach, like, the history of rock and roll and the history of music? Is that your topic of choice?
I do. It's basically once a year in the spring semester, we do a rock and roll history class, and I also teach a class on basically 20th century American history.
Okay. So were you a music fan that brought that to your curriculum, or was that something that the university suggested and you became an expert in that field, prepping, you know, your syllabus and things?
No, that was all me.
It was all you? Okay. I kind of suspected that.
I was just passionate about it, and I was actually writing, I was starting my current book, and I was like, you know, maybe we could do a class on classic rock. And so, you know, the head of my department said, sure. We did like a one-credit honors course, and then the following year it expanded to a full 3 credits of the entire history of rock and roll.
Wow. That covers a lot of ground when you think of all the different influential acts, like you mentioned the blues, and I mentioned rockabilly and skiffle and all these different flavors of music that combined into this very American music, rock and roll, that we then brought to England, and then they sold it back to us, which I thought was the whole way it worked into a circle was a very interesting process.
It's very cool, actually, and so, yeah, of course, rock and roll, you mentioned rockabilly, was born here in America, and you know, you mentioned some of the people like Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran and, you know, Buddy Holly and some of those folks, of course, Elvis and Little Richard and Chuck Berry and all those people were so, everything was the best here, and they had kind of second-rate rock stars there in the 50s. They just couldn't match up, but eventually, you know, they sort of, Brits latched onto American blues and eventually brought it back. But a lot of Americans really weren't aware of, like, they know who Eric Clapton is, but they don't know who, you know, let's say Sonny Terry, Brownie McGee are, or Muddy Waters, or any of those people are.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I remember I used to run a club back in the late 70s, early 80s, and we had B.B. King there, and I was interviewing him for Scholastic magazine. And I sat down and I said, does it bother you that, you know, you're playing this 1,600 capacity nightclub when the Rolling Stones are headlining arenas, and Eric Clapton is a legend. And basically, they took a lot of your tunes, added a little flavor, a little style to them, and reinvented them. And here you are playing these smaller clubs. And I remember BB saying, I'm extremely grateful because we wouldn't be playing here if it weren't for those guys. They reintroduced us to our own culture. Because when they were at their peak, when they were at their creative peak, of course, the segregation in America kept a lot of the white audiences from knowing who they were. And by reintroducing it through the British artists, the John Mayles and the Eric Claptons and the Stones and the Animals, they were introduced back to the American public. And he said, we wouldn't have had a career if that hadn't happened. So he was very grateful. He didn't feel slighted in any way. And I always thought that was a very healthy outlook on that.
It is, because you could see, you know, justifiably so, somebody like that being bitter about that. But to kind of say, and, you know, people like, let's say you mentioned Eric Clapton, because, you know, Clapton was so, as a lot of people were, influenced by B.B. King, and he was really on a mission to make sure everybody in America knew that they had this artist that was just, you know, generational, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, in a lot of ways, those people like Howlin' Wolf really appreciated the Rolling Stones because it was the same type of deal.
Right. Recently, I'll tell you a little personal story. Last year on the Stars, 2 years ago on the Stars Align tour, Paul Rogers is a good friend and has helped charity causes I'm involved with. And he invited us backstage. Jeff Beck was there. And one of my friends happens to be Muddy Waters' youngest son, Joseph Morganfield. And we went backstage and Jeff Beck paused when he found out he was there. He paused and he kind of gave this gentlemanly bow to Joseph. And he said, if it wasn't for your old man, none of us would be here doing this today. And I just thought that was so humbling and so wonderful that an artist of Jeff Beck's caliber at this point in his career, at this point in his life, still is that grateful for the music and the mentors he had as a young teenager.
I'm really glad to hear that, because that's a very cool thing. And I think you do see that a lot. I mean, Jimmy Page was on Letterman a few years back, and he was talking about, Jimmy Reed and, Sonny Boy Williamson and all these great, African-American blues artists. So they're all still, Clapton did a whole record of Robert Johnson covers, 2004. So they're still, it's a very good thing. I agree with that. That's a really good thing.
Let's play a song. You gave me a list of songs that you said were important songs to the book and to you, and obviously a lot of these artists you have spoken to. Let's play something, and let's get back and talk about why the 60s era of British music basically, according to your book, built classic rock as we know it today. What's a song we should play?
Wow.
Put you on the spot there.
Well, I don't know. Do you want to start with You Really Got Me?
Yeah, let's do that. That's the Kinks, of course. And we're going to get to that. It's a classic track. And as you know, listeners, we had Dave Davies on the show here just a few months back when he was in town. And this is him. Got me. And you really do. You got me right here live in the studio, back in the saddle after a couple of weeks from working at home. And Jose and I are here holding down the fort along with Stephen Tao. He is a guy that is our guest today. He wrote the book we're talking about, London Rain Over Me. And it's about the history of a certain era of British music that greatly influenced classic rock as we know it today. And of course, the Kinks. You know, everybody talks when they talk about British Invasion, you talk about the Beatles and the Stones, a little bit about the Animals and maybe the Dave Clark Five. But the Kinks and the Yardbirds and the Zombies and all these other great bands that sometimes get overlooked really had a lot of fingerprints that set up what we call classic rock today. Of course, the Yardbirds going on into Zeppelin and the Zombies branching off into Argent and all these different things. And this book, like I said, it's about 190-some pages, and it covers a lot of ground. And Stephen, how long did it take you to put this together? Because like I said, it's kind of a brief read, but you pack so much into the pages here. It seems like there was an awful lot of research that went into this.
It was. I mean, it was started really in February of 13, and as you mentioned earlier, it came out in February of 20, so about 7 years. And then basically the most of the book spends time on roughly, say, 1963 to 70. So we're talking, it basically took me 7 years to write about 7 years.
Okay. What's interesting, too, is a lot of the books that talk about the British music of the 60s focus just on the British invasion. You took us past that. I don't know if I'm accurate in saying that British invasion lasted from 63 to 65, maybe beginning of 66, but we always seem to lose the 67 to 1970-71 era, which was also very creative. That's when we had bands like Hawkwind and Crazy World of Arthur Brown, which of course led to, you know, artists like Carl Palmer coming out of the ranks and doing the prog rock thing. They were kind of the precursor, I guess, to prog rock. Why is that era? It's very... Very important. A lot of seeds were planted. Why do you think that era tends to get overlooked?
Well, I think it's because, you know, the Beatles, obviously, and then by extension the Rolling Stones and came out, just blew everybody away. It just completely changed the course of music history and cultural history here in America, especially when the Beatles came over in 1964. So you mentioned some of those early years and the Beatles and the Stones and Dave Clark Five and whatever, you know, Jerry the Pacemakers, the Kinks, you know, all those bands. But then in the latter 60s, I mean, there's, you know, there's the U.S. West Coast is doing its thing, you know, and there's this bouncing back and forth. You've mentioned this sort of ping-ponging between England and the States. So you have, you know, you have the Birds going on over in California and the Beach Boys, and they're doing their thing, and they're influencing the Beatles, and they're influencing, you know, bands in England, but it's still a super vital period, let's say, roughly, let's say, 67, 70, 71, whatever, going on in England and in London. I don't know if it's overlooked as much as it wasn't considered the British invasion anymore, but still, I think most Americans were still looking at England as that's where the best music was coming from.
Mm-hmm. Well, you look at an artist like the Moody Blues when Denny Lane was with them. They were still an extension of the British invasion. They were still poppy.
Sure.
When he left, we saw them put on their prog hat, and along with King Crimson and all these groups came along, and they changed the sound of music. Pink Floyd is probably the pinnacle of that. Everyone knows Pink Floyd, but if you listen, a lot of the people that I talk to today, a lot of the kids that come to my record store, when you run into them and they're wearing a Pink Floyd shirt, they know The Wall. You know, they know Animals. They know some of the mid-period Pink Floyd, but they seem to forget the early years. And again, that was the fertile ground for the prog rock scene. And what is your thoughts on prog rock and how it started and where it went and where it took us?
Well, for one, I mean, I'm generally a fan of prog rock. I mean, some of it I don't like, but I just think it was, you know, it was sort of like when the people that wrote rock history back in the day, they sort of said prog rock, they took things too far, it was too pompous, pretentious, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And then punk rock came along and set everything right again. And I always had a problem with that because, you know what, I liked the Ramones and I liked the Clash and all those punk rock bands, you know. But sometimes there's like a place and time and a place, you know. Sometimes I really do want to hear an entire album side of a Yes album, you know.
Right.
So just to get that out of the way. But in terms of your question, I mean, you know, that was the thing when I was writing that prog rock chapter. I had a hard time, like, saying, where did prog rock come? I was looking, you know, I'm trying to put the historian hat on and saying, did it come from, looking for that nice, neat, straight line, and it just wasn't coming to me. And then I realized that it didn't come from one place. It was kind of coming from different places, you know, European influences. Like, you start, like, say, post-1965, the Brits are starting to discover, you know what, we have some really cool influences, and we're going to start tapping into things like, you know, English and European music, old folk music that dates back hundreds of years, and they're borrowing from psychedelia and things like that as well. So there's sort of these different things, and you combine that with that era of experimentation where you could do anything. You know, as Bill Bruford from Yes was, you know, put it, he basically said, you know, you didn't have to watch the studio clock. You did what you wanted to do. And if you think about, great art is really a selfish endeavor, you know? I mean, you know, so, I mean, it, when you can have both things where you have an artist doing what the artist wants to do and the audience is buying the records, that's what you got in the late 60s, and that's what you got with bands like King Crimson and Yes and Jethro Tull and, you know, all the bands that came out of that later.
And a lot of the suits at the labels did not, couldn't wrap their head around it, did not know how to even market that.
No, and it was, fortunately we had, I mean, they did a lot better at the proggy bands here in America because there are a lot of radio stations, like here in Philadelphia, like WMMR was one of them that really, you know, was just kind of pushing at the time, you know, that they were playing whole album sides and they were open to prog rock and it gave them a whole audience over here.
It's interesting to see how some, because prog rock was being embraced on the FM, because FM was still new then. We were so used to the AM side of the dial. FM opened up that channel and really opened up to the art that became prog. It's interesting to see some of the bubblegum, if you will, the AM bands, like, say, the Monkees, when they did the Head soundtrack, and they tried to be all proggy and progressive and psychedelic, and it just fell flat. It didn't seem to work. It seems that a lot of the prog rock guys really were steeped in the classical end, more so in the jazz end, as far as time signatures and things like that, and some of the syncopations that they would use. You listen to a drummer like Carl Palmer, for instance, or even Alan White. You know, Alan came from more of a rock background, but even if you listen to some of the stuff they do, it's so far out there.
It is. I think it's, you know, you do have some jazz influences still. In fact, a lot of the blues, you know, people that came out of the blues, like, you know, Ginger Baker and Charlie Watts, and those people were all jazz drummers, you know. Mm-hmm. So people don't realize that also about British drummers, that part of the reason that those bands, like the Rolling Stones, why they were so good was because they swung, you know, and that's because people, or even like Ian Paice with Deep Purple, same thing, you know, that they swing. You listen to Smoke on the Water, it's kind of that riff, but then listen to the drums come in, mm-hmm. you know, he's not just plodding along in 4-4, that's swinging. And so, I'm just kind of going off a little of a tangent there, but I think that there's definitely that, the rhythm section that brought a lot to British rock and into prog rock, because you had people like Palmer and Bill Bruford and some of those incredible drummers that could just play in weird time signatures.
Speaking of Bruford, he wrote the foreword of this book, London Rain Over Me, your current book that just came out on Roman Littlefield. Let's talk about how you snagged a name like that. Bill Bruford is no slouch when it comes to British rock, and you've got him basically endorsing, writing your foreword, and how did that happen?
You know, I'm still trying to figure that one out. because, like, Bill is he's a brilliant guy. He is a very serious guy, and so when I first interviewed him, which is back in, like, 13, so I had to jump through a bunch of hoops to get the interview, a whole list of questions, what was my thesis, this, that, the other thing. And so he finally says, okay, I said, look, I'm going to be in London such and such a date. He says, okay, you know, I'll meet you at a coffee shop in this town called Guildford, which is like a half-hour train ride from central London. I'm like, sure. So set it up. You know, I got to Waterloo Station plenty of time. Everything's great. First, I spilled coffee on my shirt. So that was the first thing.
Love and, when that happens.
Yeah, you know, and I'm like, great. And so I'm like, okay, cool. No problem. I get on the train. I'm just hanging out on the train. And then I realized, you know, I'm supposed to be there like 10:30, and it's like 10:20, and I'm nowhere near where I got to be. I realized that I got on the local train. I was supposed to be on the express.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going nuts. I'm calling them. I'm texting them. I'm emailing nothing. And finally, I'm like 20 minutes late. Train pulls up to the station in Guildford, and my phone rings, and it goes, hello, Stephen, are you coming? You know, and I was, so I was like, I almost blew that interview, and, but, you know, the interview went well and everything, you know, fortunately it went well, and then it came time to put the book out, my publisher was like, well, you know, think of some prominent people to do the foreword, so I gave a list of names, and he wasn't initially on the list, and I don't know what it was, all of a sudden it came to me, I said, it's got to be him, you know, if he'll do it, of course, and I asked him, and he said yes, and I was like, really?
Wow.
So, yeah. Yeah, I sent him everything, a really rough draft. I mean, really pre-edited, so there's all kinds of mistakes and redundancies, but you know, he was really cool about it.
Did he give you any corrections and say this fact is not quite right?
He was kind of there was some, but he was really not so much digging into the super details of it.
Okay.
And which I was expecting to be a little bit more of that, but he was like certain things. He sent me in a certain direction or wanted me defining certain things, but he was just really helpful, respectful, and you know, I was just grateful that he did it.
You have on your website, StephenTao.com, some great endorsements. I mean, it lends credence to everything you say. The fact that you're getting such props, such respects from some of the artists that you wrote about and that who were part of this scene. Roger Glover of Deep Purple, Dave Mason of Traffic, Dave Davies, who we've had here a number of times. You know, these are people that really... You're talking about them, their craft, their art, their life, their passion, and they are saying, you nailed it, Stephen, you nailed it. That's got to make you feel pretty good.
Yeah, I was kind of, you know, whenever you do something like this, you're not, it's like you're in the forest, you can't see the trees, you mm-hmm. know, I mean, so I'm like, is this really any good, you know, it's hard to self-evaluate. And so when, yeah, some of the people like you mentioned, and, you know, people like Terry Marshall and Richard Thompson and some of the other folks you mentioned, like, came back and said, yeah, we really like this. I'm like, okay, I guess it is pretty good. So it just kind of validated it. It really meant a lot to me.
Richard Thompson is one of those enigmas, if you will, of the scene. One of those guys who were so influential, yet isn't one you think of right away when you think of impressive musicians or architects of a certain sound. Of course, he goes back to Fairport Convention. We're going to play a cut from that. But one of the things about the British rock scene that's unique, and we are still seeing it today, is the folk influences. If you go back, and I've had Ian Anderson on many times on the show here, and we've spoken about the early days and the folk sounds, and then you even see Ritchie Blackmore today doing the Renaissance kind of sound. And speaking of the band Renaissance, they have it. It's that old sound, that centuries-old sound, that they can still make contemporary. And I do want to touch on that aspect of British music in just a few moments when we return. But let's play some Fairport Convention. You picked a certain song. Why is this song a good one to select?
That's Fotheringay, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I actually, it's funny because I just this week I had my students, we covered prog rock in my rock and roll history class, and prog rock and British folk rock. So this particular song, Fotheringay, was one of the ones that I had them listen to. And I just wanted them to hear the combination of Sandy Denny's vocals, which are, I mean, I don't know about you, but my hair stands up when she sings.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
And then hearing Richard Thompson play, it's just so fantastic. And then, you know, everything that they do is kind of tapping into, you're never sure if this is a centuries-old song or it's brand new, and I think this sort of captures it.
All right, let's listen to it. We'll be back in just a few minutes with Stephen.
How often she has gazed from castle windows all and watched the daylight passing within her captive wall. With no one to heed her call. The evening hour is fading within the dwindling sun, and in a lonely moment those embers will be gone, and the last of all the young birds flown. Her days of precious freedom forfeited long before, to live such fruitless years behind a guarded door. But those days will last no more. Thank you. She will be far away, much farther than these islands or the lonely Fotheringay.
Fairport Convention, little British folk influence there during the peak of the rock scene of the 1960s. And, of course, Sandy Denny, as we mentioned, one of the great singers of her time. And Richard Thompson, who has gone on to do some amazing work over the years, along with his, I think, former wife, Linda. Are they still together?
I don't think they are.
Okay. They did a lot of stuff for a while there that was pretty brilliant as well. That music, I'm not as versed on that as I probably should be. Tell me a little more about that particular song, that era with Fairport Convention. Was that an original song? Was that a Baroque song that they gave a new twist to? What was that?
That's the beauty of it, right? It sounds like this could be something that's 500 years old, and mm-hmm. that was just the contemporary written by Sandy Denny. So, so she joined the Fairport Convention after the first record. So she was like a folk singer. There was a network of British folk clubs, very informal folk clubs, all throughout the UK, and it sort of paralleled the rock scene. And it's funny how the musicians over there are like, no, they had nothing to do with each other. They're completely separate, you know. And they were, but they weren't. Like there was some sort of bleeding of one into the other, because you can hear it. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you mention, Ian Anderson, Jethro Tull, or Led Zeppelin for that matter, or in Traffic, all those bands were tapping into that. So, and then Sandy Denny, of course, she's the only guest singer ever on a Led Zeppelin album.
Right.
That was kind of a she came out of that, and Fairport Convention were really doing like kind of covers of San Francisco, Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, stuff like that. And then they kind of influenced each other, and eventually they would evolve by about 1969 into this band that was like, well, we're going to do songs. And I think Simon Nicole, one of the guitar players in Fairport Convention, said, we're going to do songs that, that are brand new, that sound like they're a couple hundred years old. We're going to do songs that are a couple hundred years old, and we're going to make them sound brand new. And I think that was the brilliance of that Legion Leaf record, which came out in 69.
And Fairport was very influential on Jethro Tull. In fact, I think some of the members helped found that, if I'm not mistaken. Jethro Tull's got that lineage of multiple people in and out over the years. It's hard to keep track of them. But I believe they were kind of spawned from the same egg, so to speak, weren't they?
To some extent. I mean, Ian Anderson kind of was all over the place with his influences, but certainly you got people like Dave Swarbrick, who was in Fairport. He was influencing Tull, and so there was a crossover there. But Tull brought their own thing, because they had this sort of a bluesy thing, but then it wasn't, and then it was a folky thing, and they kind of rocked at the same time. So they quickly became their own thing after their first record.
The that sound, that British sound, that folky sound, didn't, with the exception of Tull, really didn't catch fire here in the States. I mean, even a band like Renaissance, which has done phenomenal things worldwide, both pre and after Annie Haslam joined the group, they never quite caught fire here in America. Why do you think that they were so appreciated worldwide, but we were so fickle here?
I don't know if I have an answer for that one. There's certain things, why did prog rock catch a hold here, like even more so than England? Or, especially because I'm from the Philadelphia area, we're a big prog rock area. I mean, a lot of those bands loved coming here. Or Led Zeppelin, nobody really thought that much of them in England. Certainly the critics didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And they come over to America and they just conquer America. So I don't know.
Do you think Zeppelin is, how do I word this without pissing off all the Zeppelin fans? Are they overrated? I mean, there's so many great bands that came out of that era, and Zeppelin seems to always be the one that gets the accolades and the salutes and the the legacy. But they, to me, they were not amongst the best, but they weren't the best. What's your opinion as someone who has worked and interviewed and obviously followed a lot of these folks?
So I would just have to tell you, I have a bias with Zeppelin, so I'm a big fan. Let's
okay.
That. Let's get that out of the way. So you want to take what I'm saying with a little bit of a grain of salt, but I hear what you're saying because there are so many great bands. I just discovered a band called Leafhound, which had one, I say a couple years ago, I found out about them. They had one album. You know, it came out of the same era of you know, British blues, late 60s, and their record sounds better to me than the first Led Zeppelin record. So, you know, a lot of it is timing and luck and that sort of thing and connections and, you know, and Peter Grant, their manager, and promoting them properly. But you know, none of it happens if they weren't, they had something indefinable, you know.
Right.
It's like a Neil Young, like you go, are there better guitar players than Neil Young? Oh, yeah, they're better singers, definitely. But if you put it all together, it's more than the sum of its parts. It's Neil Young, you know.
Right.
So I think that they were kind of like that.
Another band that you mention in here and that couldn't buy a single or a hit in America, but yet are super respected worldwide, is the Pretty Things. And you chose a song, SF Sorrow Was Born, which is probably one of their pinnacle songs, one of their epic pieces, even though it's very short. What's the connection with the Pretty Things? Why were they so influential, and how were they so influential that you spent time with them in this book? A lot of people, they're almost like a footnote to many people.
I think that this was one of those bands that I felt needed to get some props, you know, that hasn't. They were, without the Pretty Things, probably a lot of what we would call prog rock wouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And they did this single called, they were actually just backing up a little bit with them, and they were kind of like the grunge version of the Rolling Stones in the early days, you know.
Yeah, they were hard-edged in the beginning.
They really were. You know, Phil May, the singer, he had his hair down to his shoulders in 1964, way before anybody was doing that. So they were dangerous, you know. They were really scary. They forget about the Stones, you know. But then they kind of got tired of that kind of bluesy stuff, and by about 67, they did this single called "Defecting Gray." They're breaking all kinds of rules, and then they do this this rock opera, you know, in 68 called SF Sorrow, and a whole storyline, a whole thing. Wait, you know, actually like 6 months before Tommy came out by The Who, and yeah, it just got completely overshadowed because Tommy became this enormous phenomenon, and Who, of course, went on to become what they became. And I said, you know, these guys really did, they did this before The Who, and
mm-hmm.
they really need to get some credit for bringing something to the party, which is part of the sort of anthemic part of rock and roll and telling a story and progressive rock.
Now, was this the SF Sorrow album, was this pretty much the end of Pretty Things, or did they go on after that? Because I know they were friends with David Bowie and I think Mark Bolan of T-Rex, and I know they were very influential on those artists. Did they continue on? I don't seem to hear much or see much about them after SF Sorrow.
Yeah, I mean, not in exactly the same form. They ended up getting picked up by the Led Zeppelin label in the mid-70s, Swan Song. So
okay.
They were still around. They just weren't quite, you know, as influential as they had been.
All right. Well, let's take it back to 1968 from the SF Sorrow album. This is SF Sorrow Is Born. Pretty Things.
Nobody thought there would be family laughter behind the windows or a Christmas tree. Then a couple from up north, Sorrow and his wife, arrived. Before the sun had left the streets, they were living inside. Before too long, the street it rang with the sound. From number three there came the cry, SF Sorrow is born. SF Sorrow is born. SF Sorrow is born. SF Sorrow, SF Sorrow,
of sorrow is born.
Spent in the gray of his mind, as he stole love with a tongue of lies, the world is shrank in size.
SF sorrow is born. SF sorrow is born. SF sorrow. SF sorrow. SF sorrow is born.
Beating the hoot of the punch about 6 months before Tommy, SF Sorrow came out. That is the Pretty Things, influential band from England. We are talking with Stephen Tao here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, the Midwest Beat Show. And his book, London Rain Over Me, has been out about 6 weeks now, How England's Capital Built Classic Rock. And you're hearing the foundation, the building blocks of classic rock with some of the artists we've been playing. Stephen is with us for just a few more minutes. We'll try to get to another song here. One of the things I do want to touch on, and you play him up as well, another artist that the average bear may not recognize, is Arthur Brown, the Crazy World of Arthur Brown. And I first heard about Arthur Brown, it was an old British TV show. And he was so over the top. And, of course, they played the big hit that's still famous here, Fire. And he came out as the god of hellfire, and he would light his head on fire. Literally, light his head on fire. And I remember having Alice Cooper on the show a number of times. And we always talked about theatrics and different things. And one of the things that he had mentioned early on was being impressed with Arthur Brown. And you play that up quite a bit in London Rain Over Me, Stephen. How influential do you really feel Arthur Brown was here in the colonies, as they say? I know Alice was a big was influenced heavily by them. Who else might have been?
I mean, Alice Cooper, as you mentioned, has mentioned a number of times that he wouldn't have existed without Arthur Brown. The whole idea of theatrical rock, the shock rock, the type of thing that Arthur Brown was bringing to theater into the music as a presentation, really hadn't been done before. So, you know, so he's influential on him. People like David Bowie, you know, all mm-hmm. and so, I mean, you could kind of go on and on in terms of people that kind of took things. It wasn't just about standing there and playing songs, but actually presenting yourself a certain way and creating an element of danger too, you know, to the performance. Because he literally, like you said, he's literally like lighting. Like, you could never get away with that stuff now.
Right.
Imagine somebody doing that now. But, you know, he'd go at the Marquee Club in London and have this, like, colander on his head with, they call it petrol, you know, we call it gasoline, mm-hmm. and he'd, like, light it on fire, you know. So, yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Now, here in the States, we had, what was his name, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, Put a Spell on You, who was, likewise, very theatrical in his approach. He came out as a, like, a headhunter kind of guy, and but just like Screamin' Jay, Arthur Brown only really had one well-known hit, at least here. The only one I can think of is Fire. Was he bigger in England as far as charting and hits and radio play?
Well, at the time, that was like his only like big like number one hit. But, you know, it wasn't... By that time, by the time he got to the latter 60s, albums had replaced the singles, so it wasn't quite as important. So he was able to kind of maintain that to some degree. Unfortunately, there were some issues on the tour with Carl Palmer was on it as well, and Things kind of fell apart, and Palmer left the band, went on to Atomic Rooster, and eventually to Emerson, Lake & Palmer. So he never, you know, he's one of those guys that he's still performing, he's still doing it, but he didn't necessarily become, you know, insanely world famous as some of the people that followed him.
Arthur Brown is still performing?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, too. I mean, I've got a friend of mine out in Seattle who's into all that kind of stuff and saw him maybe a year ago and out there, and yeah, loved it.
Wow, I'd have to look into that. I'd love to see some footage of him performing. You have interviewed countless artists for this book, and as you mentioned, it was 7 years in the making. Of those artists, I'm not going to ask you to name favorites or least favorites. Who most impressed you, I guess, as an interviewer, that you really walked away from that interview saying, I never would have thought this guy would have been this way? Was there anyone in particular that stands out?
There were a lot of people that, I mean, very few of the interviews that I didn't enjoy. Most of them were just, you know, people, because I'm living vicariously through these people, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had to pick one off the top of my head, I'd probably go with Greg Lake. You know, and I mean, I like Emerson, Lake & Palmer, but getting to talk to him, and he was very different. A lot of times when you interview people, and I don't know if you've experienced this, but when you start to interview people at a certain level, you know, they'll be very professional and they'll tell you things and whatever, but he went beyond that. He was kind of very warm, and he wasn't so much playing himself up, but he was talking about being a fan and seeing, you know, opening for Jimi Hendrix in Brighton in 1967 and how that just impacted him, or seeing the Beatles for the first time. He even talked about, you know, Elvis, and I think just his passion for music and artists, other artists, was what impressed me.
Okay. You have written another book before this about grunge, comparatively speaking. Again, I know they're both like children to you, so you're not going to pick a favorite, but which one do you feel closest to?
Well, I mean, the Seattle thing was my 60s. Right, because I'm technically a boomer, but I'm really not, because I wasn't part of that whole 60s thing.
Okay.
So it all happened. By the time I came of age, it was well over, you know, late 70s by the time I came of age. So, you know, so the Seattle thing, when Nirvana blew up, it was like, yes, you know, all those bands. So I really had a deep connection, but, you know, I think that was maybe a little bit more personal because I experienced it firsthand when it was popular, but the music that came out of England and, as I mentioned in my book, in London, well, that was something that I discovered on my own 20 years after the fact. So in the 80s, my friends were listening to Madonna and Duran Duran. I was digging into the Stones and Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles and the Who. So it was very passionate for me, too.
Okay. Now, did you put as much time into The Strangest Tribe, the grunge book, as you did with this one? Because, like you said, you invested 7 years in this book. How much time, comparatively speaking, was The Strangest Tribe, considering that was the first of the two?
It was a little shorter, maybe 5 years.
Okay.
And I think, I mean, the London book, just to give you an idea, the Seattle, the issue was, because I wrote about it when it was really underground, so the issue was finding the information. So I had to find, you know, obscure bands' recordings by bands like 64 Spiders and Overlord and things like that, and you know, and find these weird fanzines that are long out of print to get information. Whereas London was the opposite problem. You know, like in Seattle, they had one magazine newspaper called The Rocket. It came out once a month, and it kind of talked about some of the music that was going on locally. In London, there were four weeklies. Coming out.
Right. Melody Maker, The Express,
yeah.
All that.
Yeah. So, okay. I mean, just the amount of time just to sit there and go through page over page of the Melody Makers, New Musical Express, and Record Beer, and you know, it just took longer.
Right. Well, we can keep up and get both books online at his website, which is Stephen Tow, T-O-W, StephenTow.com. And, Stephen, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. It was a lot of fun.
I'm glad it finally happened.
Me too.
What's the next book? When can we expect it?
Oh, well, here's what happens. I'll tell you, it'll take a couple years. It's always 3-4 years longer than I think it's going to take. So I don't know. I've been digging into a couple possibilities. Maybe I'll do something in my backyard, maybe something on Philly Soul or something like that. We'll see.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. We'll keep up with you at steventow.com.
Thank you, Tom.
Bye-bye.